Hi, I'm Dominique.
And I'm Adriana, and we are Survivor Sisters.
Survivor Sisters is a podcast and organization that shares the stories of sexual assault survivors to educate, empower, and inspire other survivors and their peers to take action against sexual assault. Hello, everyone. Long time no see. It's been such a long time since we've recorded. We intended on taking a much needed break at the end of last year, in December 2019, to get ready to gear back up for the spring of 2020. And we all basically know how that went with the coronavirus and the pandemic kind of halted all of our plans. But we're back and we're so excited to be here today with Rachel Brooks, who is a sexual assault survivor from North Carolina. And she is the author of Beads, which is a memoir about falling apart and putting yourself back together again. We are so excited to have Rachel here with us today. Rachel's story is a little bit different from what we focused on in our first season of the podcast that aired in fall of 2019. That project was more focused on sexual assault on college campuses, but we felt it was important to kind of open up our podcast as we continue to grow and evolve to stories within all different contexts with survivors from all different walks of life and all different backgrounds. And so while Rachel's story is not an instance that happened on a college campus and deals with the separate issues that arise in those contexts, it's still absolutely a very important story to tell. And we hope you enjoy hearing from her. We're so excited to hear from her as well. So with that, I will allow Rachel to introduce herself a little bit further and share her story.
Awesome. Thank you both so much for having me. I'm honored to be your first post-COVID podcast guest. I'm Rachel Brooks. I am a first-time author of Beads, a memoir about falling apart and putting yourself back together again. I was born and raised in Raleigh, North Carolina, and currently live here with my husband, and we have two kids who are 5 and 2. So a little bit about my background, and I'll dive right into my story. Like I said, was born and raised here in Raleigh. I went to school at UNC Chapel Hill here in North Carolina as well. And the year that I graduated, I was 22, and I moved up to Washington, D.C. to begin an internship at an accounting firm. And about 3 weeks into that new venture, it was first time really that I had lived outside of North Carolina, separate from studying abroad in college, but first time in a new city, big city, and went out with my cousin and a couple of her friends one night, and I was getting a cab ride to go home, and unfortunately, the cab driver was not a cab driver. Coming from a college town that was very small, I had never really taken cabs before, so I didn't really know any different. And I got into the front seat of this man's vehicle. He was on the phone pretending to chat with another customer. So no red flags really. There was no meter, but I also didn't, again, know much different. So, I still felt fine. It was very, very early in the morning as I had made the decision to go home rather late in the evening. I had been drinking that night, but had not drank for a couple of hours when I got this so-called cab. So as we progressed, he unfortunately pulled the car over and claimed that he was lost, got off the phone. And at that point, when he turned the car off, I knew that something was not right. He then proceeded to pull out a weapon, held a knife to my neck, maneuvered himself onto my side of the car, pulled down the seat lever, and next thing I know, I am laying there with a knife to my neck and a stranger on top of me. He proceeded to rape me, and I essentially went into freeze mode. We've all heard the saying fight or flight, and both of those were not really an option for me because I was in a car on the side of a highway in the middle of the night. Essentially, I had no idea where I was because I'd only lived in the city for about 3 weeks. And if I had gotten out of the car, there was fear that he would come after me. And to be honest, where would I go? So I basically went into survival mode, frozen mode, complied with everything that he asked, and really thought that I was not going to make it out alive. I had visions of myself being posted on CNN headlines the next morning. I ran through, you know, kind of my whole life's worth of thoughts and thought that that was it for me at 22. Fortunately, he had a one-track mind and got back on his side of the car and dropped me off about a block away from my apartment so that he wouldn't see where I lived. And so immediately exiting the car began this whirlwind of a process. I had a horrible experience with the DC sexual assault unit, made to feel very much so like a statistic. Virginia punted me to DC, and there was a huge jurisdictional issue throughout the course of my case. The detectives who were assigned to my case did not believe me when I began telling my story, and they really tried to pick at every little detail and every little possible thing that could negate what actually happened. And I just recall thinking, how could they not believe me? I'm not one to make this up. And I found myself trying so hard to let them know that I was telling the truth. And they did take my report, so I was thankful for that. I then had to go to the hospital to get a rape kit, which I knew pretty immediately that I wanted to report. I wanted to have evidence. I wanted this man to be caught. And so the rape kit process was also very grueling, lasted about 3 hours. And that was followed by a 2-hour wait for the sexual assault nurse examiner to even arrive at the hospital. So as you can imagine, I mean, I was still wanting to preserve all of my evidence. So I had all the same clothes on. I had not eaten anything, drank anything, showered, brushed my teeth, none of that. So just really sitting in a lot of filth for a very long time. So at the end of that day, I was just kind of numb. Honestly, I was very broken. I had no idea what my next move was going to be, what my life even looked like now. I mean, it just was a very surreal experience that, quite frankly, I don't wish on anybody. But moving on from that day, you know, there were just several series of events that sent my life into turmoil. My case lasted about 4 years, and I won't give too much away because my story is in the book, but it did not end the way that I would have thought. But in the end, I was able to receive closure and become more at peace with everything that had happened. So my recovery through this time when I didn't hear anything from the police for about a year and a half and really just tried to move on with life the best that I could. I turned heavily to alcohol. I had this, you know, very strong, confident persona on the outside when I was sober. And then when I would drink, I would turn into just a very sad, scared. I was affected by triggers. I would talk a lot more about the attack when I was drinking and then wake up the next morning and, you know, kind of pretend that that never happened the night before so that I wouldn't have to deal with it. I was in a lot of intense therapy. I still am in therapy, not very regularly now, but I tested out a series of antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication to help with the PTSD and the panic attacks and the nightmares, and all while trying to maintain this image that everything was fine, when in reality, it was not fine at all.
Something that really stuck out to me, and I don't know if it's just, like, unfortunately, I wasn't very shocked to hear about the way that the detectives, when you first reported, how they handled your case. And I don't know if that's just because I'm jaded and I've been within this realm for a while now, but I wasn't shocked that they tried to discount what you were saying and they didn't take you seriously and tried to blame it on the fact that you were drunk and a bunch of, I don't know if you want to talk about the other things that they did that were just horrible. But what I was shocked at, or not shocked, but maybe surprised is the better word, was although you encountered a lot of bad inhumanity during this time, which a lot of survivors do, especially if they choose to report through whatever avenue, whether that's college or through the legal system. But I was surprised at all of the good inhumanity that you also encountered through, like, your workplace, how accommodating and comfortable that they tried to make you as you navigated the legal process, as you navigated just the aftermath of being raped. And then also your amazing support system, your mother, your boyfriend and now husband, your cousin, your friends, all these people who played such an integral role in supporting you. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how they helped you go through the after effects of all of this.
Absolutely. So it's a great question and really a great takeaway from the book. So I think having a support system is so huge being a survivor. And unfortunately, not every survivor has that support system, whether it's because they haven't told anybody or they know their attacker. There's an imminent threat of danger. And so therefore they feel like they can't tell anyone, or, you know, a whole series of reasons why a support system wouldn't come together as it did in my case. But yes, I have been so fortunate over the years to have this amazing foundation of support that has seen me through the good, the bad, the ugly, seen me through those drunken nights and sober conversations, and through the court process and everything in between. And I think had I not had that, I think that my recovery would have looked completely different. I think, you know, a lot of survivors, including myself at times, we just feel so isolated. And I was very fortunate to be able to reach out to that close-knit group that I had during those times where I was really struggling. When I finally found a good therapist back here in North Carolina, that was also huge. She was a very pivotal part of my support system, and actually allowed me to text her whenever I needed. And just seeing how people were able to come around me and support me and not judge me, it just made it so much better. And like you said, it really did help to restore my faith in humanity a little bit, because, you know, I would hope that everyone who goes through some sort of trauma would have at least one person in their life that they could turn to with no fear of judgment or you know, backlash or anything like that. And so that also played into a big part of my writing, that feeling of being isolated and kind of feeling that you're going through this process alone. And I wanted to be a support for someone, whether anonymously or if they would want to reach out to me just to allow other survivors to know that they are not alone in their recovery process. So kind of a multifaceted answer, but yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that the support systems that you have can really make a difference in your healing process. And it's very unfortunate that so many people don't have support, whether it's they can't share it or the people around them don't believe them. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to kind of segue into a conversation about how you had a relationship actually at the time of when you were assaulted and hear you talk about how that really impacted being in a relationship while being assaulted by a complete stranger and just the kind of things you went through on like an intimate level and just like a personal level.
Absolutely. So I can tell you it did not end well. As anyone can imagine, an event like that is pretty earth-shattering, and given how young we were, not that it makes a difference, but we were living together at the time and we were so very young, very much in love. And, you know, it was very, very difficult on our relationship after that. I wouldn't say that we were in a great place before the attack happened, but afterwards, we kind of went in different mental direction. My boyfriend at the time really wanted to fix it. He wanted me to go to a sketch artist. He wanted me to he wanted to find this man who attacked me, and not saying that I didn't, but I was reeling much more from the psychological aspect that I don't think I could truly communicate at the time. So I would never fault my boyfriend for any of his actions. I think that he coped and did what he needed to do to get through that time. And it was just very hard for each of us to convey our thoughts and feelings to the other person to get them to understand, because, you know, we were just both so traumatized from all of it. My boyfriend, he actually was the first person to see me as I exited this man's car. The car was gone, obviously, but I was, you know, running half naked down the streets of Alexandria, Virginia. And, you know, I will never truly know what that did to him to see his girlfriend in that way. And, you know, unfortunately, we were not intimate after the rape. I just couldn't, I couldn't go there. I couldn't for a long time after. And, you know, that was the very last thing on my mind. But it was definitely a factor that played into just the downfall of our relationship. And we sadly ended up breaking up at the end of that summer. But, you know, he, you know, we did the best that we could given the circumstances. And, you know, I really did wish him the best and, you know, just that he was able to heal and move on in his own way. So it was really tough. It was really, really tough. There was just, you know, I think relationships, especially when you're young, are hard to begin with. And, you know, we were both kind of just jumpstarting our careers and I was getting ready to go to grad school. And then you have this huge unexpected wrench thrown in and, you know, it can really go in one of two ways. You can make it or not. And so we, you know, it was for the best that we parted ways. I definitely think it was the right thing for both of us, even if we didn't realize that at the time. But yeah, it was a really, 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 cannot say that enough, really, really tough time to be in a relationship after something like that happened.
I think that once you go through something like that, relationships with anyone, whether they're platonic or acquaintance level or a romantic or sexual relationship, like they're all hard for so many different reasons. Yep. And it's all kind of shaped by the experience that you had, not only just with your assailant, but also with like the police and the detectives that were handling your case. And it didn't seem like it for you, but for others, potentially when they confide to others and how they react, if they react in a negative way, that also can play a role. So I think trust and intimacy and all these different things are definitely tested when you go through something like this.
They really are. Yep.
I wanted to shift gears a little bit more to kind of the legal process. So you touched a little bit earlier on the fact that the original detectives on your case were very flippant about what you were saying and what you were reporting, and they didn't really believe you, which unfortunately is something that many survivors experience when they go to report. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to ask if you can speak a little bit more about the legal process as a whole, because I know that there was down the road at least some silver lining to the new people who kind of came into your case.
Yes. So
I'm going to talk about that process.
Yeah. So I will openly admit that I was completely naive to the justice system. I had never really dealt with police before, other than a speeding ticket that I once got. So I immediately thought to myself, okay, so I'm going down to the nation's capital, the DC sexual assault unit, not just the police station. I'm going to the specialized group that deals with these types of crimes. So I felt like I was going to be in the best of the best hands. And, you know, this was, again, very shortly within the hour after my attack happened, and I was dirty. I was exhausted. It was about maybe 5 o'clock in the morning at this point. So the city was very quiet, and it again was very surreal because everything was so quiet, but everything that had just happened was just so loud, metaphorically speaking. And so when I got to the police station, I felt relieved. And lo and behold, I was about to get re-victimized over and over and over again over the course of about 5 hours, the questioning. And it was really like I was the one being interrogated. And you know, that was so disheartening for me. I understand that they have a job to do, and there are unfortunately situations where people are lying about being raped. But that makes it just that much more difficult for the survivors and victims who are telling the truth, right? So I think that is the huge one of the huge reasons why a lot of victims do not report is for fear of not being believed. And that was definitely the case for me. However, the more that they did not believe me, the more I felt like I needed to report, if that makes sense. So it was the more that they did not believe me, the more I needed to prove to them that this was happening, and the more determined I was to see this all the way through, which is kind of crazy to have all of those thoughts so quickly after something had happened, but it was almost that, or after my attack had happened, but it was almost like I went into this fighter mode where I made the decision that I was not going to let them intimidate me to the point where I would retract or get up and leave, and so on and so forth. So as brutal as the experience was, I ultimately was very thankful that I did report, because it did lead me further along in the investigation, and you know, I was finally able to figure out who the assailant was, and you know, that was very very important to me. That was my main goal. I needed to know who this man was. And so, you know, the detectives, they did all sorts of things that were just very unruly. They put me back in the squad car about midway through their questioning, and wanted to have me see if I could remember where the attack happened. And, you know, I'm right back in the front seat of a car. The detective behind me is just telling me that I was drunk. I was making this up. The driver is just trying to jog my memory with street signs, exits, and I just kept repeatedly saying, I really don't think that I'm going to be able to identify where this happened. And so after about an hour, we head back to the precinct, and the head detective decided to put his lights on, pull up onto a curb in downtown DC at a Starbucks, get out, get himself a latte and a muffin, and get back in the car, which just, I don't think I realized the severity of that or the impact that that had on me at the time, but that to this day is still one of the most angering things that they did that day.
Yeah. I mean, I would say as a reader and having been sexually assaulted myself, that just reading that part in the book, especially because it's literally right in the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
Just reading that part of the book infuriated me for so many reasons. Because we have the re-traumatization, and then they're just kind of treating it as like a joke.
Another day in the office.
Another day in the office. And
yep,
it's sickening because these cases are second to murder. They're extremely important, extremely horrific. Mm-hmm. And he just goes and gets a coffee and a muffin.
Yes. Knowing also that I had not provided any evidence yet. So, you know, I'm starving, I'm thirsty. And so just very, very, just very discouraging. And, you know, at that point, I needed it to wrap up, and felt that I had done all I could at that point. And so moving past that, when my case essentially blew back open, when they finally tested my rape kit after a year and a half, which, you know, could be a whole another podcast episode, the issue of the rape kit backlog and my very small experience with it, you know, learning as much as I have over the years, you know, a year and a half is not really that long, which is also just incredibly disheartening to think that there are so many survivors out there whose rape kits have never been tested, will never be tested, got lost. You know, they just became another statistic, essentially. Thankfully, mine was tested. And, you know, when my assailant was identified and we were moving forward with a case, I was able to have the opportunity to ask that those two detectives not be on my case. So I was very, very thankful to have that voice in the process. Cause I think that, you know, that's another hurdle that survivors will face, is just having a lack of voice in all aspects of the situation, the process. And so when I realized that I could request that, I did. And I was then put into contact with an amazing detective, a female detective. And she was just so wonderful and really sympathetic, empathetic, just so wonderful to my family and me, and you know, just made me feel that I could move on in the court process, that I could proceed. It was still very grueling, but then kind of having that additional support from the police was very huge for me.
I think like all these things that you mentioned before, just the way about how the detectives took a coffee break, or how even just the whole rape kit backlog in general, all these things just kind of show survivors that they don't matter, that they're not being taken seriously, and almost like silencing them in a way, which is why we're so glad that we have you here, and we're so happy to hear from you and have a platform for you and other survivors to come on and share their stories and kind of take back their voice and the narrative around that. And we're so glad that in the end you did have, you know, detectives and the legal team who were advocating for you and who were on your side. And we're not going to give away like the ending of the case or anything like that, but that was really great to see, because so many times this goes so wrong. Mm-hmm. In so many ways. But I want to shift gears to beads and to the writing process, and basically what inspired you to write a memoir and share your story in that format.
Well, I will say that it is something that I never in my wildest imagination ever thought that I would do. I am not a huge reader. So, which is, you know, may come as surprising to someone who wrote a book. But, you know, I was literally in my husband's car, and it was the fall of 2017. So just about 3 years ago. And the Me Too movement had just exploded. You know, it had been around for a while, but then there was the Harvey Weinstein, the infamous Harvey Weinstein case, and all of these women and men that started coming forward sharing their stories, whether they related to Harvey Weinstein or not. And I just felt so inspired. And I literally said to my husband, I was like, this is the craziest idea, but what if I were to write about my story? And he said, yeah, I mean, I think you should go for it. I think you definitely have something here that you can definitely turn into something, you know, whatever that may look like. And so that day we kind of started spitballing ideas, and I was just taking a few notes on my iPhone. And then I convinced myself that I was crazy, and how could a CPA who was pregnant at the time, already had a child and had no background in English whatsoever, write a book? So I talked myself out of it for several months, but it just kind of kept coming back, and I kept feeling compelled to just sit down and see where it would take me. And so several months later, I did just that. I sat at my computer and I just wrote the words chapter one, and really started from, you know, a little bit of background on myself, and then basically started from the day before everything happened. And I was shocked at how quickly the words flowed into the computer that first session that I sat down and wrote. I think my chapters in my book are very short. And, you know, so I cranked out quite a bit in that first day. And, you know, I would work on it here and there slowly but surely. And by the end of that year, I had been connected with an editor who had edited the book of another local author that that I knew. And I told myself, if this editor decides that I have good content, that I will continue. But if she decides that that it's not, then this is it for me. And so when she decided to take me on as a client, I was completely shocked because, you know, that told me that my words and my story, the draft, the first, you know, several pages of the book that she decided to take a look at, they were actually worth something. And so that was a huge vote of confidence for me, and really pushed me into the next step, which was completing the whole first draft of the manuscript. And, you know, my editor and I bounced it back and forth a couple of times. And within 6 months, I decided to submit it to two publishing houses, small press, boutique firms. And I heard back with them, from them both, within 48 hours, wanting to wanting to publish me. And so once again, complete shock, excitement, and, you know, just all of the emotions, and really looking at just how I started with this idea, really reeling from the impact of the Me Too movement to now, you know, actually having a publishing contract, and having to essentially decide between two publishing houses and who I was going to go with, and so on and so forth. And so the rest was essentially history. We spent last summer getting the book in tip-top shape, going through more rounds of editing, designing the cover. And last November, it was born. So yeah, it's been a really wild ride. And I think that it is just one that, like I said, I feel like if I can write a book, really anyone can. So yeah, it is really something that I'm so proud of, and, is a, memoir about, you know, essentially the last, well, decade of my life at the time that I wrote it, and, just how I have evolved and how I've come to the other side of all of the trauma and grief that I experienced earlier on in my life, and how I coped and where I am today, and you know, why I'm doing the things that I do today. And I think it's just a very raw, conversational, accurate depiction of the many struggles that victims of trauma go through.
Yeah, and having read the book, it was not a shock to me that all these publishers wanted you and that you're back so quickly. Honestly,
it was that
it was such a quick and easy read, and it was so, you're such a powerful storyteller, and it was really engaging and really grasped my attention and held it. And I think I read it in like a few hours, although I am a fast reader and I love reading. But it was probably one of the best books that I've read this year. And I've read at least 50 books this year so far. Like I read a lot. So it really was amazing. Like, just, you told your story and you were so vulnerable and open and unfiltered, which I really appreciated. And I think a lot of survivors, just a lot of people in general, I think this is such an important story to hear. And so we definitely recommend that you pick up a copy of Beads and hear it for yourself, because it was just, I thought it was incredible.
Thank you. I really cannot thank you enough for your kind words. And, you know, I think it's, you know, I wrote the book in a way that it was as if the reader and I were sitting and having conversation much like this. You know, I wanted it to be very a quick, easy, you know, not easy content, but easy sentence structure and that sort of thing, so that people could relate to it and pull the emotion from it as much as they possibly could. And so I'm so very glad to hear that that's how it was conveyed, because that was definitely my goal. So I thank you.
So tell us about the famous metaphor beads.
Okay. So it's kind of a two-part story. This is a chapter in the book, and right after the rape happened, my mom, who is just such a wonderful person and has been my rock since day one, and she took me away from DC. We were going to go to her mountain house in the North Carolina mountains just to escape, have a change of scenery, you know, start to heal, whatever that looked like. And as we were driving, she asked me, if you could pick one place, what do you want to do? I'll get you whatever you want. We'll stop wherever you want. And so I have always been kind of a craft junkie. I love arts and crafts and you know, making just little collages and scrapbooking and all of that. So I, first place that popped into my head was Michael's, the arts and crafts store. And my mom said, done, we're going to find a Michael's. So we walked in and, you know, it was honestly like one of the most beautiful things I had ever seen. I had been in a Michael's 1,000 times in my life. But just having a complete newfound appreciation for really everything in my life at that point, because I didn't think that I was going to make it out of that vehicle alive. And so just my perspective, my immediate perspective on so many things had changed. And one of those was the aesthetics of the inside of a Michael's. And so I was just giddy. I was so excited. And I wandered around the store and perused all of the aisles, and I landed on the bead aisle. And my mom and I just started filling our cart with everything, jewelry, bead oriented. So my mom was throwing in like bead books, jewelry tutorials, bead trays, earring clasp, necklace strands, all these things. And for 2 weeks at her mountain house, I sat in the loft, I watched Lifetime movies, and I made this hideous jewelry out of these beads that my mom ended up spending $400 on, by the way, at Michael's. And so I spent all this time making this jewelry, and I just thought that they were just the most beautiful, amazing pieces that I've ever created. And I did not realize how therapeutic it was for me at the time, but that was really the beginning of my healing recovery journey. And after those 2 weeks, I never looked at those beads ever again. I still to date have never made another piece of jewelry. And, you know, as I was writing the book, I started writing that chapter, and I had a different name for the book initially. And so after I wrote that chapter, I started to mull over just the importance of those beads and how much they really impacted me and have stuck with me over the years. And so I decided to name the book that, and the metaphor part, kind of the subtitle is a memoir about falling apart and putting yourself back together again, is this whole idea that you imagine yourself wearing a necklace and it's ripped from your neck and all of the beads scatter everywhere. And, you know, some you'll pick up right away, some you will be lost forever, some will break, some you'll find many years later in life, and slowly but surely you'll restrand your necklace and it's not going to look the same as it did when it was pulled off, but it will eventually become whole and yours again, in whatever fashion that may be. And so I was able to kind of weave that metaphor throughout the book, just my process of quote unquote restranding my necklace. And I kind of have a continuation of that metaphor. I have a blog called The Beaded Survivor, and each blog post is a different, again, quote unquote, bead of life. Just, you know, anything from parenting, hobby, COVID, you know, just self-care, all those sorts of things that we all need, you know, on our necklaces of life.
Definitely.
And so, yeah, it's just kind of, it's cool and crazy how the name evolved, but, yeah, it's just a fun story of the meaning of the title. So.
Yeah. And I think it's definitely a powerful metaphor and really like sums up the whole scope of the book and from the beginning to the end. And actually one of my favorite parts of the book was at the end, after everything had gone down with the legal process and all that stuff, when you're actually talking about getting married and having your kids and navigating career changes to becoming a stay-at-home mom, and then ultimately the advocacy work that you do with your local nonprofit and writing beads. And that was kind of my favorite part of the book, and almost made me a bit emotional there, just to see like how far you've come. And I think that a lot of people, whether they've experienced sexual assault or some other form of trauma or other painful life event, especially in that moment, they feel like, oh my God, this is never going to end. I'm never going to be happy. I'm never going to achieve my dreams or reach my goals. And this is always going to haunt me for the rest of my life. And I thought it was so powerful that like you did kind of put all the beads back together, and you got some new ones along the way, and you kind of became whole again and started to really heal and move forward.
You say it so perfectly. And, you know, I think it's important to also note that it's not something, you know, this type of trauma and many other types of trauma are not something that ever really go away. We just become, it becomes a part of, you know, it does not have to define us. It just becomes a part of who we are. And I think that that was a huge concept for me to grasp, because for so long, I really thought that, you know, this was going to consume my life, just as you had just said, and really thought that I was going to be a victim and have to deal with this aftermath for the rest of my life. And while there are, you know, triggers very few and far between now, present day in my life, you know, it still sticks with me, but I do find a lot of joy in sharing my story and connecting with others and helping, others in whatever trauma that they have experienced, or whether it's a friend or a family member or what have you. So I really can't thank you both enough for, reading the book and inviting me as a guest. And, you both are just such a pleasure to talk with. So
thank you.
I really applaud the work that you're doing. I think it's just amazing and so important, and, will touch, and I'm sure already have touched so many people. So it's really awesome.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate that. And, likewise, I mean, it must not have been an easy thing to do to share your story like this. And then, you know, come on here again to, you know, recount it as well. And I'm sure you probably went back and forth, should I share it, should I not? But I think it was really brave and ultimately will help so many people who come across it, whether they're survivors themselves or not. I think they can learn a lot from the book. And I know, not having experienced sexual assault, I learned a lot from the book as well. And I picked up on a lot of great life lessons that you threw in there. And yeah, we just want to thank you so much for coming on here and for sharing your story once again. To all of our listeners, definitely check out Beads, order it on Amazon, find it at a local bookstore. We'll link all of like the information on how you can order feeds and where to follow Rachel on social media and her website and all that stuff. Honestly, I can't say it enough. It was such an incredible book, and I know that if you give it a chance, you'll enjoy it. And Rachel, it was such a pleasure to talk to you. We appreciate it so much. Thank you for coming on here.
And, absolutely. Thank
being
you.
So open.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And yeah, looking forward to keeping in touch.
Yes, of course. Yep.
Good luck with future episodes as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So you can keep up with us on social media, on Instagram at Survivor Sisters, on Facebook at Survivor Sisters Podcast. We're available anywhere where podcasts can be found, Spotify, the Apple Store, the podcast app, Stitcher. We post on YouTube as well. So all over the place, really, anywhere that you can listen and stream podcasts. We also have a merch store where we donate some of the proceeds to nonprofit organizations that fight sexual assault. And so that's all linked in our Instagram bios and all that stuff. And again, we'll be linking where you can find Rachel's book, Beads, and where you can keep up with her as well. We hope you're all staying safe and healthy during this crazy pandemic. And we hope to keep recording, and we'll keep you posted on social. But yeah, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
We will not be silenced.